This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Well, hello everybody, I'm Doug Levy, bringing you episode number 2 of my podcast, Under the Radar, Olympic Athletes You Gotta Meet. And it's inspired in part by my book, Hero Redefined, Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. Shout out to the great folks at the Sports History Network for this podcast, and an even bigger shout out to my next guest. I mean, if this guy doesn't get you inspired about the Olympic Games, I'm not sure who will. If you want to hear about a quintessential athlete and underdog who overcame challenges and put his body on the line and brought great honor to his country and himself, you need look no further than Kurt Tomasevich. Walk-on football player at the University of Nebraska, bobsledding novice who then excelled at the sport, Olympic champion. Kurt, it's an honor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here with you and get a chance to talk.
Great. Well, Kurt, I want to get into your story and the prospects for U.S. bobsledding in the 2026 games. But first, if you don't mind, I'd like to introduce listeners to the sport of bobsled. First off, when you decided to try it, did anyone ever come up to you and say, hey, man, are you nuts?
Yes, that's definitely when I started, and actually all the way through my career. That was a common question, I think. Well, as you mentioned, I went to the University of Nebraska. I grew up in a very, very small town in Nebraska, and bobsled was not a popular sport, to say the least. And so when I was toying with the idea and I told some people, including my parents, about the possibility of doing it, I got a lot of funny looks for sure.
So let's take a little deeper dive if we can and help people understand what it's like. Because as I think you know, outside of the Olympic Games, many of us don't give it a lot of thought. So it's a sport that apparently originated in the 19th century in Switzerland. And what a sport. I mean, you are on this piece of equipment. There's no seatbelts. There's these intense G-forces. You're zooming down a sheet of ice. You're reaching speeds of up to 80 miles an hour. I read that bobsledder and track athlete Lolo Jones once compared it to being thrown in a metal garbage can off of Mount Everest. So how would you describe it for the uninitiated among us?
Yeah, we've used that analogy quite a bit, you know, sitting in a washing machine and just being tumbled. And a lot of people think it's a nice, smooth roller coaster ride, but yeah, it's quite violent. The ice is, there is no Zamboni machine. So the ice is not, you know, your indoor, you know, very cared for smooth sheet of ice. It's pretty rough. And then obviously trying to drive a 1400 pound sled, 80 miles an hour, you know, you're on the edge of out of control. And, you know, so you bounce off walls and it's just very violent is a good way to describe it. But man, it's a rush.
Yeah, I get the feeling that you like that rush. So maybe let's go back a little bit to your childhood and growing up years in the cornfields of Nebraska in a very small town, and an anything but conventional entree into college football. So if you wouldn't mind, take a few minutes and take us through that journey.
Small town in Nebraska in the 90s, when Nebraska was definitely more of a powerhouse than they are now. Playing for the Cornhuskers was my big dreams. Playing outside every day, my neighborhood consisted of a lot of kids my age. And so we were always playing sports, games, Video games weren't something that interested us. We were just always active. And so as I got into high school and kind of learned I had an athletic talent, I wanted to play for the Cornhuskers. I didn't earn an athletic scholarship there, but I got an academic scholarship. So when I went to Nebraska, I had to try out for the football team, basically. And when I did try out, there was 120 other kids trying out at the same time. And of those 120, they ended up keeping three of us. And so I was pretty lucky to join the team that way. They asked me to be a running back on the team. And so, again, running that option offense of the 90s, early 2000s, again, I thought I was going to, pave my way right to the NFL being a running back. But it turns out my role is more of a scout team running back. And so I look back at how that shaped me and my character and, getting yourself up off the ground, going against the black shirts, every day. And, that really taught me a lot. So, very, very grateful for that opportunity, even though it obviously didn't lead to a path in the NFL.
And I read that you played linebacker as well. So did you do a little bit of two-way playing for the Cornhuskers?
Not two-way at the same time. I was a running back for the first 2 years, and then coaches thankfully did realize I had some athletic ability. So to get me on the field a little bit more, I went from running back to linebacker. But yeah, throughout all of it, mostly special teams and contributing that way.
So that's an uphill story of overcoming some odds, and yet you hit some real milestones at Nebraska, Kurt. You played fullback, you played linebacker, as we talked about. You got academic all-conference honors. Probably more importantly, you got bachelor and master's degrees in electrical engineering. But I get the feeling you were still a little restless, and as I understand it, you then get a piece of advice from a female track athlete, So, can you maybe take us from there? I'd love it if you could tell us the name of that athlete who literally changed your trajectory in life.
Now obviously I wasn't going to the NFL, like I said, so I was continuing to work on my master's degree at Nebraska. I still wanted a way to stay active and train and do something. That was a huge part of my undergrad life, so I wanted to continue that. So one of the strength coaches, Brian Bailey, allowed me to continue to work out in the football weight room early in the mornings. I kind of look back, I was kind of his guinea pig. He would run me through some pretty intense workouts, and I feel like if I survived, he would then apply them to the rest of the football team. But throughout that process, a former track athlete, Amanda Morley is her name. She was recruited to be on the women's national bobsled team because of how she competed at the NCAA championship meet. So, kind of hearing her story kind of opened my eyes. I 23 years old at that time, and I'd never seen a bobsled in real life. Like most people in the 90s, I'd heard of or seen the movie Cool Runnings, and that was really it. So, she convinced me I had the right body type, strong, fast, powerful, and a little bit crazy. And the timing was good for me to try out for the team in September of 2004. So that gave me basically 2 full years to learn the sport to try to make the 2006 Olympics.
I got to ask you, have you ever gone back and circled back to Amanda and emailed her or called her or said, "Hey, thank you." I mean, did you ever have any of those sort of after the fact conversations with her?
Actually, after we won the gold medal in 2010, in retrospect, I thankfully spent a lot of time kind of looking at how my story came about, and I spent some time thanking some key contributors. And yeah, she was one of the top people that I called and thanked for putting this crazy idea in my head.
Yeah, that must have been a cool conversation. So, you've alluded to your career a bit. And obviously, for our listeners, you did more than try bobsledding. I'd say you crushed it. So, can you, it's tough to go back, I know, but can you try and go back and paint the picture for us on how this walk-on football player became so gifted in bobsledding? We're going to talk about this, but you went on to Olympic medals. You graced the cover of Sports Illustrated. That's pretty iconic stuff in 2010. So maybe take us back through that if you can.
Again, never thought that I had a talent for bobsledding. I mean, it's not like I pushed my friends faster on the merry-go-round or, anything like that when I was a kid. The only sledding that we would do as kids in Nebraska, not a lot of hills, so we would actually just tie one of the round saucer sleds with about a 40 or 50 foot rope to the back of a four-wheeler and drive around in the streets sometimes in my town and the fields, the pastures, and that's what we called sledding. So again, I didn't think I had a talent for actual bobsledding. But yeah, as you kind of mentioned, I was athletic and pretty fast, pretty powerful. I had a pretty good vertical jump, which are some of the key things that the bobsled recruiter or coaches, they look at to see if you have the potential to push a sled. I had to fly up to Calgary, Canada for my very first bobsled trial. It's where the US team was training at that time. And when I got up there, yeah, they ran me through a series of combine tests. Went pretty well. And yeah, for whatever reason, running in a funny pair of shoes and spandex with a helmet kind of came naturally to me. And I was able to work my way up the depth chart pretty quick to the USA 2 sled for my very first season on the World Cup circuit.
Yeah, I get the feeling that Kurt Tomasevich is one of those guys who, when he hears the word no, it really inspires him to figure out ways to get to yes. And from my research, it looks like you even had some premonitions. You joked a little bit back in the day about trying bobsled. So, what was that like? You'd obviously seen it, had some thoughts enter your brain, and then coming back around to doing it and pushing up against the odds.
Yeah, that is true. When I was in high school, one of my friends and I, we kind of joke when the, I think it would have been the 98 Olympics when they were on TV. Remember kind of watching them and thinking, man, that looks like the simplest way to make an Olympics, right? You push for 5 seconds and then you go for a run. I severely underestimated what it really takes to be a bobsled athlete. But yeah, that was a kind of a joke in high school that I never gave it a second thought until they reminded me, couple decades later, that remember we had that conversation one time. So, yeah.
I love that. So, Kurt, you end up appearing in not one Olympic Games, but three. And 99.999% of us will never have a clue what that feels like, right? So, help us reimagine. Maybe you'll be our guinea pig. What it was like, and maybe touch on some of your biggest highlights and memories from those Olympic experiences.
Yeah, I'll keep trying, but putting it into words is not an easy thing. Setting the competition aside, just the whole experience of going to the opening ceremony, you have the sometimes ridiculous looking outfit, but it's patriotic, and when you're walking through the tunnel as a team, and you got your little American flag, you're waving to the crowd, and the crowd itself, my first Olympics in Torino, Italy. They didn't necessarily speak English, but there was this common Olympic spirit, and you know why everybody's there, and it's just like truly an incredible honor to be able to represent the United States at an opening ceremony, closing ceremony as well. But just being in the athlete village too, you're eating and you're across the table from a ski jumper from Finland or a speed skater from the Czech Republic or whatever. Like, you have nothing in common with this person other than this ultimate goal of being the world's best. And somehow or another, you kind of form these friendships, and it's kind of a cool atmosphere. And yeah, those are the things that are never captured on TV or that's just part of the experience that I'm never going to forget.
Well, I'm a little surprised because you didn't mention 2010, and you're part of a four-man bobsled in those Olympics, and you're with the great Steve Holcomb, as I understand it. And maybe if there are a few bobsledders who broke through anonymity and gained some creds and recognition with the mainstream public, I'd maybe single him out as one of those guys, the late Steve Holcomb. That That must have been an incredible trip. Tell us about that if you don't mind, just zooming back a second.
Yeah, a lot of stars and planets aligned when I tried out for the team. Basically, the timing was amazing because that would have been, I think, Holcomb's third year on the world, second or third year on the World Cup circuit. So he was really just starting to kind of, find his stride and make his way up the international rankings. And so when I joined the team and I was paired up with him to be on his two-man and four-man teams. I was incredibly fortunate to be his teammate, be his roommate, really, when for 10 straight years, and one of my greatest friends too. But what I really liked about the sport of bobsled, I played football, I played basketball, a number of sports growing up, but in bobsled, it's a very, very small sport, and you and three teammates on a four-man sled, you have to get along. And all your training is together. There's a very, very tight camaraderie that comes with being on a four-man team that doesn't always exist in other sports and teams. And so it was truly special when we got kind of nicknamed the Night Train. And it wasn't just the name of our sled, but it was kind of who we were too. And we had t-shirts made and all kinds of things. And it really kind of became our persona as a team and not just individually. So that really just added to the fun of winning in 2010 and having our success there and bringing it all together.
I love that. And it's got to be a little bittersweet too, as you think back to someone like Steve, who's no longer with us and got ravaged by cancer. And I saw too, in going back through your career, you also have some bittersweet memories about your dad, because I'm guessing he was a very big influence in your life. Never really got to see you reach the pinnacles of bobsled. How far along did your dad see you get?
My dad never saw me compete in person. He did pass away actually 6 years to this day, November 26th here. He never saw me compete in person. And what's kind of weird about bobsled as well is most of our competitions are obviously in Europe and around the world. So for somebody to watch us compete, it's waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and trying to pay attention there. But, he always followed our results. And again, this was early 2000s a little bit, so texting internationally wasn't as prevalent, and he wasn't big on email even. But when he got the opportunity and chance, he'd always send me positive messages and let me know one way or another that he was pretty proud.
Yeah, I bet he knows. And what would be your first sentence someday when you see him up there?
That's interesting. In many ways, again, he wasn't a man of a lot of words, I guess. But I always knew and kind of felt how much he cared and what his support meant. He worked incredibly hard as a combine mechanic for John Deere when I was growing up. So very busy during the fall season. But he tried to find a way to get to my football games and basketball games and always try to be in the crowd when he could. Again, wasn't obnoxious yelling and screaming or anything like that, but seeing him there meant a lot.
Great. Well, you've been, I want to have you talk a little bit about just your role these days. You've been gifted an opportunity. Not only do you continue to work with the US team, but looks like you're very used to being a speaker, and you've gone and spoken to audiences. And I wonder if you could tell us what the main things you try to share with people in the audience are. You mean about bobsledding, about sports, just about making your way in life. What do you try and message out to people?
Again, I tried out for bobsled in 2004, and throughout all of that, at least initially, I thought this would be kind of a fun weekend and a great thing to tell some friends that I once tried out for the bobsled team. I had no idea that it was going to turn into a 10-year career as an athlete, and then now it's one of my full-time jobs that I do as director of sport performance for the program now too. But yeah, as I started to have some success, pretty quiet success, I guess, when it's not in the Olympics, but some people from Nebraska in my hometown and their neighboring counties, kind of learned of my story. And so I started to be started to get requests to come and speak to, their third grade class or their Cub Scout group or, something pretty small. But, over time I kind of learned that, this is a great way to, try to positively influence, younger kids, generations, older people too, no matter what it is. And my story can kind of create some inspiration. So, 2010, after we won the gold medal, I think in that year alone, I gave about 120 speeches and appearances,
Wow.
which kept me incredibly busy, two, three schools a day sometimes or more. And again, it's really an opportunity to talk about, first of all, just tell my story and then try to slip in messages and lessons that I learned along the way, whether that was, trying something new and facing a fear or, making the right choices, even though they may not be the most popular choices, different things like that kind of helped me get to where I am now.
And overcoming obstacles. I mean, there must be a mental toughness in your makeup that helped you do that. Is it possible to translate that for others? I wonder. I mean, I consider myself a pretty resilient person, but I'd have a difficult time helping people land on the right thought process or mission in life to help them overcome the way that I have. You've overcome in so many cases. Is it possible for you to encapsulate that for those you speak to?
Yeah, I think obstacles come in many forms, right? Sometimes they're just major setbacks, injuries or things like that. Fortunately, I was able to avoid a lot of significant injuries, but I think just my background coming into the sport, never having seen it before, I mean, that was a major obstacle. I had a lot to learn, when I first tried out for the team. I had a lot to learn about training. I was a football athlete that, in football, you're taught to get from point A to point B, and you don't think about what your technique of sprinting and running and that sort of thing is. So I had to learn how to be coachable and in a different way. I had to become aware of my movements and very critical of how that my biomechanics I could be. So in a way, those were kind of the obstacles I needed to overcome. Athletes I was competing against, they've been doing the sport for a long time. They knew more than I did when I started. And so again, I had really had to focus, study, and make the extra effort when again, some other people had just a, again, they grew up with it or they had a natural ability. And again, I had to just in a way kind of outwork them to get to the point.
Yeah, so there's some terrific messages there. Well, let's now go out a bit on a macro level to your place of being affiliated with USA Bobsled. To start with, I'm wondering how we're doing as a country. As I understand it, there are only a couple of facilities in the United States, and our team is typically recruiting fast twitch athletes from other sports, and I just wonder how that journey's going for a country that, as we've talked about a bit, has had to play catch up with the Europeans when it comes to excelling. How are we doing?
Yeah, I mean, for obviously a major powerhouse nation in athletics and sports, we, the expectation is we're going to be the world leader in everything that the United States does, right? However, admittedly, we are not the most popular sport in the United States. So when we compete internationally, yeah, we aren't necessarily the team with the deepest pockets when it comes to funding and technology. We're really trying to be as efficient as possible with the funding that we do have to make the most high-tech sleds possible. When we recruit athletes, yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of times, well, we call it talent transfer, right? We're taking athletes that are talented in other sports, maybe not going to make it to the most elite level in their sport, but they can be fantastic bobsled or skeleton athlete. And that's who I try to recruit now for our sports. So yeah, a lot of track athletes, a lot of football, but I mean, we don't care if they come from CrossFit or dance or swimming or whatever it is, you know, fast, strong, powerful athletes. That's who we're looking for here. So yeah, internationally we do, you know, we compete pretty well on the level. We're expecting, you know, a few medals at the upcoming 26 Olympics. I'll admit Germany is usually the favorite, or they have been for the last few Olympics for sure. In Germany, there are four tracks. In the United States, obviously a much larger area, we only have two tracks. So the tracks per capita ratio definitely favors, you know, Germany and some of the other European countries there too. But we you know, we hold our own many times, and you know, we are expecting to do pretty well up this coming February.
Yeah, I had a chance in doing my book to interview Aaron McGuire, and he described it much like you have. You have to often find these folks from other sports who can run, who can jump, who bring power, and can acclimate to cold weather and, you know, tough surroundings in terms of the climate. So I guess you end up with a hearty few souls who have a lot of backbone and a lot of want to.
Yeah, I think that's the factor that's hard to put in writing and really try to, it's hard to describe. But in our sport, yes, we're looking for fast, powerful athletes, and we can measure that, you know, by sprint times or jump distances or heights or, you know, how much can you squat. You know, those sorts of things are measurable. But once you get into the sport, you nailed it, right? There's a lot of heart and kind of off ice tests that we have to put our athletes through. We are definitely a blue collar sport. Yeah, we have a, you know, a sled mechanic, you know, that works on the sled, but for the most part, you know, we're turning the wrenches, the bolts, we're putting the runners on, you know, polishing the sleds, you know, all this stuff to make it fast. We don't have equipment managers that do that for us. Also just the travel itself, you know, we're traveling away from home. The race circuit, the World Cup circuit, is, you know, sometimes months on the road, hotel to hotel, yeah, different foods, languages, all that stuff. So again, that in itself has driven away athletes before. You know, they may be great, you know, have good talent, but you know, they're just not cut out for the lifestyle of being a bobsledder. On top of that, and I sometimes hate to admit this, you know, but you're not going to get rich bobsledding, you know, especially now with college athletes getting paid, you know, through the NIL system, and you know, then they come to our sport and kind of wonder, well, how much money can I make doing this? And, well, not much, that's for sure. But you know, it's a not about the money. It's competing for your country. It's testing yourself. It's, you know, those sorts of things are what keep the best athletes around.
Yeah, that's a great tribute you just gave to the sport. I think of this analogy of the crew team members in college sports who they're up at 4 in the morning, they're never going to get rich, they're selling programs at the football games before they start, and all of those things that we as armchair athletes or non-athletes never see. So Mr. Tomasevich, I'm going to have you transition into a pregame broadcaster for us here, and let's skip ahead to the upcoming 2026 Winter Games in Milan Cortina. My crack research staff of me, myself, and I has done some looking at these World Cup teams. It looks like on the women's side, we have some women bobsledders who have previously medaled, like Kaylee Humphries and Alana Myers Taylor and Sylvia Hoffman, maybe a little more unheralded squad on the men's side. Can you maybe forecast for us from your perspective who you think has a good chance in the upcoming games on the 2 and 4 man sleds, and who you would maybe ballpark as the best medal chances, both on the men's side and the women's side?
Yeah, you nailed it. On the women's side, we've done very well in every Olympics since women's bobsled came in 2002. We've won medals there. So again, that's obviously huge for us. And yeah, we have some of the best veterans in Kaylee and Alana as pilots that you just mentioned. Keisha Love just won a world championship last year in monobob. So those three bobsled pilots, are really going to kind of lead us to what we're hoping for, a few medals in just those two disciplines. We've got really good push athletes to support them too when we get into the two woman bob. On the men's side, yeah, you are right. We haven't won an Olympic medal since 2014. And like I said, Holcomb passed away since then. So he was truly the program leader. And, the door is open for the next, men's pilot to kind of step up. This season, yeah, we have Frank Del Duca and Chris Horn, who, again, they have the potential. And in fact, this past weekend, there was a World Cup race on the upcoming Olympic track. And there were glimpses of them doing really well. So, I mean, I'm expecting a couple top sixes. And yeah, there is the chance that either of those two could lead their teams to win medals there as well.
And there's so many variables when you get to the Olympic Games, of course, and you never really know if it's going to be your day or not your day. Are there any kinds of particular challenges with Milan Cortina that you foresee? I mean, you've competed in Olympics in another location in Italy, but are there any, particular things that the team has tried to gear our men and women up to be watching out for or to adjust to, if you will?
Yeah, that's a really good question, very in depth. Yeah, the track is brand new. There was a track that existed in Cortina for the 1956 Olympics, but obviously that track has kind of aged out. So they built this brand new track. Again, the first time we had the opportunity to truly compete on it was this past weekend. We learned a lot. It's probably not going to be a track that has a lot of crashes, but the competition is it's going to require a lot of driver skill. The start is going to carry the teams a long way too. So, yeah, it'll be a great competition in that way. The rest of the World Cup season leading into the Olympics, again, that's going to also serve as a way for our pilots to keep learning, getting better. I mentioned the two men's pilots. Again, they've got potential to do well, but they just need to learn some consistency. And I think that can play a huge part of it too.
And as a how-to for listeners of the podcast, as I understand it, we still don't have finalized Olympic teams. We've got World Cup teams that are competing amongst themselves for those slots that then get awarded for the games themselves.
Yeah, in a way, there's kind of two qualification processes going on at the same time, right? We have to compete and qualify internationally. We have to qualify quota spots at the Olympics. And then it's up to the coaches and a selection committee to name the athletes, the American athletes, to fill those quota spots. So, a lot of times the athletes that earn those spots are the ones that, take those quota spots. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that are going on, within the races, between the races, that try to help determine the teams here. But yeah, I think January 19th is when we officially have to name the Olympic team.
Well, and if I can put in a little bit of a plug, I would encourage people to just go online and look at the men's and women's World Cup teams. I think you'll see a lot of impressive people. Forget the athletics for a second, just some really impressive people. And then, as we talked about earlier, ex-track athletes, ex-gymnasts, ex-football players who are transitioning into this crazy new sport. So let's hope for the best for Team USA when we get over there. Kurt, on a final note, if you wouldn't mind just telling us what else you've got going now. You've got a world you live in at the University of Nebraska still. You've got your Team USA duties. Tell us about a typical day or week in the life of Kurt Tomasevich.
Yeah, I in some ways I try to balance two full-time jobs, I guess. My real full-time job, director of sport performance for USA Bobsled and Skeleton. And that really entails a lot of wearing a lot of different hats. Sometimes I'm with the team on the ground, holding a video camera or lifting sleds and moving them around, trying to help the team, very directly. But a lot of the time, I'm helping create the selection procedures, the criteria, designate who earns stipends, although meager, and trying to help the athletes that way. I'm also working with our coaches a lot, trying to come up with the best plan and schedule for them and the team. I work a lot with the sled technology programs that we have, trying to develop the fastest sleds for everyone. So yeah, a lot of things that come with that. On the other hand, this semester I do teach two classes in engineering at the University of Nebraska. And again, I don't have a research appointment with the university, but I'm helping a lot of students kind of design their own senior design projects or different research opportunities for them too. So throughout the day, I'm bouncing around from different meetings, switching, like I said, very dramatically different hats sometimes.
Yeah, I get the feeling that that Kurt Tomasevich doesn't have too many of those chilling out on the back patio with a martini in hand. And it wasn't good enough for you to get just an undergrad master's degree. You have a PhD as well, right?
After I was in bobsledding 2014, I got my PhD in biological engineering, and mostly focused on biomechanics. And I always kind of look at that. That's how I tie in engineering with my athletic background, is kind of pulling those pieces together.
So I have to ask, as someone who's got his hand in a few different pots, what's a perfect day look like for Kurt Tomasevich? What's a day where you're like, oh man, gotten to do all these things I love. This was the best.
I definitely find reward in seeing our athletes race and compete. So in a perfect day, sounds crazy, but I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch a race that's happening in Europe, and I see our teams do well. I go into work in my office at the University of Nebraska, and I teach a class, and I have reward in seeing students do well. And one of the things I really enjoy is, sometimes teaching engineering is pretty challenging and difficult, but there's many times where you can actually see in a student's face kind of an aha moment, and where something just clicks with them. And I know that those are the better days I have teaching, so that means a lot too. But then, yeah, I mean, just accomplishing things to create a program within the bobsled and skeleton program that can set us up for success. And sometimes that's looking from a 30,000-foot view, but sometimes it's working one-on-one with athletes, and creating their strength and conditioning program too. So yeah, I'm sorry to ramble here, I guess, but there's a lot of parts that I can truly find joy in.
Yeah, I guess an analogy I'm thinking of as I hear you talk about this, Kurt, I spent a lot of years as a youth coach, and for me it was these moments when the light bulb went on for a kid. So you don't so much remember the kids with all this innate talent. You remember sometimes the ones who might struggle or might have difficulties, and then something happens and a light bulb goes on and they see, here's where I can get from here to there. And a great thing for you is at both places, you must get a few of those athletes or students or at your speeches, people who you see maybe have a little bit of an awakening moment, I guess.
Digging pretty deep. I think it is those moments in life where you realize that you're having a positive influence on somebody, whether it's as a mentor or a coach or a teacher, just a peer. Sometimes, I think that's what can truly hang your hat on at night and say, yeah, that was a really good day.
Well, with that, Kurt, I just want to again thank you. Reading your story pumped me up for the Olympic Games. I'm a lover of the Olympics, so it doesn't often take too much, but I know I'm going to be paying special attention to bobsled. We've got you on record, so we have some of your prognostications here, and we'll see how you do. And thanks again for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Doug.
Okay. All right, folks, that was Kurt Tomasevich, former gold and silver medal winning bobsledder, and just doing great things in Nebraska and for Team USA. And for our next episode, just as a quick preview, we're going to be talking with Summer Bricher, a three-time luger for the United States women's team, who hopes to be in her fourth Olympic Games at Milan Cortina. And we'll hear a little bit about Summer's story and her aspirations for the coming games. Until then, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.